This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome back. This is a extended version of Joy on Paper today. I am so thrilled that I have been given this extra hour as a gift from Tantalk Radio Network, and so I'm able to add more people to this wonderful day celebrating the fifth anniversary of Joy on Paper. And my guest now is somebody, the minute I read this book, I said she had to be on the program. Mary Doria Russell wrote a book that really is very relevant to me, and it's called The Women of the Copper Country. And I want to welcome you to the program, Mary.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you.
Whoa. You know, I am from the Copper Country.
Are you really? What part of the Keweenaw?
I was born in Baraga, and my father was one of 13 children. Two of his older brothers, and he was like young compared to them, were killed in the mines.
Yeah.
And so, so this story is so relevant. My brother and sister in-law still live up north in mm-hmm. Pelkey. And so she brought me this book at Christmas time, and I was so thrilled to get it. I had read your previous book, Sparrow, but this book, you know, there are so many relevant things in this book to me because I have walked these streets. I spent my time every summer up in Copper Harbor. My girlfriend's family had a house there, and so I spent every summer up in Copper Harbor. So I've walked these streets, and I know these people, and I know these... I'll let you explain what it meant to be Copper Country, and why the factories and, you know, we used to have all of these mining towns where they owned everything. So I'll let you tell the story, because it is a fascinating story. And from my perspective, being a Youper, because that's what they call us when we're from the Upper Peninsula.
Yes, from the UP, the Youpers.
The Youpers, we're Youpers. And I was born there, and we moved to the city when I was older, like in third grade. But I still had some of that Youper accent, and so I sounded a little bit like this because you know I had that sound that we have, because my background is Finnish, but there were many different nationalities there. So tell us about this story about Copper Country.
Okay, the Copper Country is in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It was the richest copper deposits on the planet at the time that it was discovered, and the company that was the best at extracting the minerals was Calumet and Hecla, which was based in what is now Calumet, Michigan. And like you say, they were they had an entire city. It was known as the Paris of the North. Very rich deposits, which were the reason for a buildup of banks and legal offices and engineering and all of the manufacturing that went into the machinery to get the minerals out of the ground. So by 1913, it was still quite prosperous there, but it had begun to come under competition from open pit mining. The copper in the UP is quite deep, and it had been mined for 50-60 years at that point. And so they were miles underground, and it was very expensive to get it out of the ground. And so if you can just blast through the upper crust and pull out the ore directly. It's much cheaper. So you had a company that was trying to cut costs, and it was doing through automation, which is something that happens, you know, we're seeing the very same thing today. It's a continuing trend in industry. But in 1913, labor costs were an enormous amount of the overhead of the company. So the management had decided to bring in what were called one-man drills. And that would have cut the labor costs in half, because usually they used to have two men on each drill. But for the miners, it was suddenly a much, much more dangerous way to bring the ore out. It was a 150-pound drill. Only the biggest, strongest men could handle it. They would be 50 to 100 feet away underground from anybody else. If something happened, it might be hours before anybody noticed that they were missing. Whereas if you had a partner, there would be somebody to spell you on the drill and to go for help if something happened. So that was the flashpoint. And efforts to unionize the miners, to get them to bargain collectively for safer working conditions and also for a raise to $3 a day. That was organized by the United Mine Workers, but the Western Federation of Miners. There was a man in charge of this called James McNaughton, the CEO, who ruled Calumet with a viceroy's power. He ran the lives of 40,000 people. And he said, grass will grow in the streets of Calumet before I recognize a union. And so that set off what was a seven-month strike.
Well, I want to stop for a minute. I want to play a little song for you that introduces a little bit of this story.
Okay.
Take a trip with me in 1913. Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country. I'll take you to a place called Italian Hall, where the miners are having a big Christmas ball. Take you in a door and up a high stairs, and singing and dancing is heard everywhere. Let you shake hands with the people you'll see, and watch the kids dance round the big Christmas tree.
There's okay, well, that song sort of sets the scene for
that's right. That's
1913.
Right.
But let's
That's Whitney Guthrie, right?
Oh,
but
yeah.
Arlo singing it.
Yeah,
right. There was, you know, God bless. It wasn't the miners' ball. It was a Christmas Eve party for the children of the union, which made the outcome even more tragic.
But let's take a step back before that. Let's talk first about the beginning of your book, because first of all, I want to tell you, book is really, really wonderful. And I love the way that you have put a quote from Shakespeare in the beginning of each chapter. And the prologue is gripping. And I where you've discovered this story and how you've made it so intriguing is with this prologue. Tell us about Big Annie.
Big Annie Clements. Yeah, I stumbled onto this. I don't have a connection to the copper country the way you do. I had finished up my last pair of books, Doc and Epitaph, which were about Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday. I was just kind of taking a break for a while and watching television, just PBS, and I stumbled across a documentary called Red Metal, which was about the strike. In the midst of this, there was a kind of a brief mention of Big Annie Clements. And here's a photograph of her, and she is literally head and shoulders above the rest of the people in the strikers' parades. She led the picket lines for months. She was 6'3" tall, and carried this enormous American flag every single morning. She said that it was very important to show McNaughton and the copper officers that it wasn't laziness that was keeping the strikers out. But what crossed my mind was, my Lord, how did that work? She's 25 years old, and she's leading a miners' strike in 1913. Where did that come from? How did she become the kind of woman who would step outside the boundaries at a time when women were supposed to shut up and keep house and have babies that would be the next generation of miners? And so I started thinking about her story and what it takes to make a woman like Annie Clements. I just happened to put that out on Facebook, and within like 15 minutes I got a reply from a friend of mine who said, my great-grandfather was the last man to die in the mines before the strike took hold. And I was, wow, I need to talk to you. And so I just kept pulling on that thread. And one of the things that really struck me when I did talk to Rivka the next morning at breakfast was that I had originally thought of this as a straightforward good girl, bad guy story. I would have Annie Clements as the heroine and James McNaughton as the as her nemesis. And Rivka said, well, all I can tell you is that in my family, the names Annie Clements and James McNaughton were both spoken with reverence. And I went, wow, okay, I really need to think about this for a while. So a lot of the nuance of the story and the fact that it isn't told, I begin with that quote from Romeo and Juliet, which says, two houses both alike in dignity. That was a reflection of what Rivka pointed me towards. I certainly did sympathize with the miners more than I did with James McNaughton, but it made me try to present his side of the story as accurately as I could.
Well, you do write his character and his story, his part of the story. It's fascinating. So many things about him are fascinating, and when you go up north now and you see Calumet, and I mean, it's hard to imagine the number of people that were there. It's hard to imagine when you see, for example, when you see some of the old buildings, and you see, it was such a vibrant place. It was a place where there was theater, there were famous people came through. Caruso sang in Calumet.
Caruso sang there, yes. All of the big names were there. That's what I mean when I say it was known as the Paris of the North. It was, and to this day, when you go to Calumet and you ask about Annie Clements, she's a very divisive figure, and the strike is still a live issue up there. Many people still believe that if she had not made trouble and started the strike, that the copper mining industry would not have died there. What I tried to show in the book was that it was already dying. The company saw the strike as a good way to get rid of half their workforce, because many of the miners were leaving the North to go to work for Henry Ford down in Detroit. And they already knew that it wasn't going to be long before they would not be able to compete with the surface mines in the West. So that town was going to die. But it's easier to find somebody to blame than it is to understand the nuances behind the decisions that the corporation made. So that's what I mean about trying to
it's a fascinating story. You bring in all the different nationalities. Of course, there were a lot of Italians, and one of my relatives married one of the Italians who came over, and I think they called coffin boats or something. They brought in a lot of Italians, and they still we have relatives who are Italian and have an Italian restaurant in Hancock. And when you were there, did you take that trip down into Quincy Mine?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I also went up even further into the peninsula and walked through one of the mines that was opened in the 1850s. Just to get a sense of the changes that had occurred in the mines and the amount of human labor that went into clearing the overburden of rock is stunning. There was a big change in the ethnic makeup of the miners. It starts out with Cornishmen and Welsh miners who were born to it, who had generations of experience in the mines and took great pride both in their knowledge and in their willingness to undertake the dangers of being underground. The workforce was coming mainly from Scandinavia and from Southern Europe. And this is a time when immigrants were, they were contemptible. And you can see that in the attitude of McNaughton towards the workforce that he has. He has no respect for the people who are coming over at that time. Another echo of what we're hearing today. But there was, everybody had their own churches. Everybody had their own languages and their own food.
Yes,
and it became, through the union, people were brought together. And we're exchanging the recipes. And it was all, the thing that I wanted to show was how central, how basic the women of the Copper Country were to the strike. Miner strikes in particular are often seen as something that only the men did. But they could not have kept those strikes up if there weren't women behind them stretching every bit of cabbage and bread and gardens, making gardens, canning food, raising hogs.
To keep it
they
going.
They were the ones kept the kids going. And
we have a word up there, and Youpers use the word, it's a Finnish word, sisu.
Sisu.
And boy, our women have that. I mean, we're gutsy, determined. We still are.
That was a very important word in the book that I had to teach the readers who were not familiar with it.
Exactly. It's a word I use often. And another word, of course, is pasties.
I will have to tell you, there is an audiobook version of Women of the Copper Country. And she's a very good reader. And she handles, there's like four dozen different accents that she has to do.
She didn't say pasties.
And she does really well with them. But she does refer to pasties as though they were what strippers used to use.
Or ornaments of strippers. Yes, yes.
And every time she says pasty, I just shuddered.
I know.
I do know the difference. I want everybody to understand that was not my error.
Exactly, because there is nothing like a Youper pasty.
They are
the best. And my brother, when he comes down, he comes always with a ice chest because he's bringing pasties down.
Yes.
So
yes.
He was just here at the holidays, and he brought pasties because, you know, although I can make them, and I could really, like in the book, probably make them with my eyes closed because I know the feel of the dough, I know everything, but still there's something, it must be the water, something really great up there.
It could be the water. It really could. Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's funny when we're talking about the mining companies and how they had mining, they set up these houses, you know, one after another, and I still have relatives who live in Baltic, where they have
you know,
those.
And you can see the the houses that were built for the miners were meant to last. Because, of course, they had to stand up to 4 feet of snow on an ordinary winter. You know, one of the things that the union organizer is surprised by is how substantial the houses are, because he's used to the tent cities that were set up in the West and in West Virginia, shacks, really. And Mother Jones
and
points out...
And it is true. Those houses, I have relatives in Baltic... Which is just,
they are meant to live. They have lasted over 100 years.
Yeah, they are. It's incredible. You can't believe it. Now they were small and compact, but boy oh boy, and then they raised big families in some of those houses.
They sure did.
But
yes,
I'll tell you the truth. I had a relative in Baltic, and they had a big family, and they had one of these company houses. And it was one of the happiest places in the world. So,
yeah.
But your story, the women of the Copper Country, is really, really fascinating. I would like to recommend it to everybody. Everybody.
You don't have to be a youper to like it.
No, you don't have to be a youper. You learn a lot. For me, of course, I know copper, and I was really happy to hear how you described how really important copper was in those days,
it still is.
The story is fascinating. Each of the characters, you've really drawn a wonderful, wonderful story here. Of course, you're a great historian yourself, and you've done a beautiful, beautiful job with this book. And when people finish this one, they can go on to The Sparrow and Children of God. Your books are fantastic, and I would love to have you back again. This is my special 5th anniversary program. The studio gave me an extra hour, so I was so happy that I could have you on, and I want to thank you for being on, and I want to thank my sister-in-law, Debbie, for giving me this book, because...
Thanks, Debbie, for me, too.
Okay, and she will help promote it. She is still in the Copper Country. Happy youper, and... Mary Doria Russell, do you have a webpage that you want people to go to?
Yes, and it is just Mary Doria Russell.
Okay.
Two S's, two L's, and Russell.
That's it. And they can find you.
That's it, yeah. And www.marydoriarussell.com.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me. And I'll have you back on. I would love to talk to you more about The Sparrow, which I think is a fantastic book, okay?
Sure. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Happy anniversary, and thank you for including me.
Okay. Bye-bye now, Mary. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. We're going to have a little promo here that we did for our wonderful sponsor, Glenn Erickson. He's written a book called Android Love, and Big Ed did a wonderful promo for him.
From the pen of local storyteller Glenn Erickson comes a tale of romance and suspense. A truck driver encounters a beautiful woman fleeing in the night. Why is she running? Who is she running from? When Richard stops to help her, he has no idea his life is about to change. His quiet life as a widower is turned upside down when he discovers that Marie, as she calls herself, is really an advanced android, one who not only has escaped those who created her, but who has become self-aware. She wants to be free. She wants to live. Can Richard protect her from the corporation that claims her as their property to do what they want with her? Will Marie be able to find justice before she's captured by a bounty hunter? Android Love is a new type of love story. Does an android have the right to feel love? To form an unshakable bond with a human that defies logic? The story of Richard and Marie will touch your heart and get you thinking about the world of the future. Are we prepared? Android Love, written by author and storyteller Glenn Erickson, is available on Amazon KDP.
Okay, well, please get that book. You will love it. And I want to thank Glenn so much for supporting Joy on Paper. He has made just my life so wonderful just with his support. And I want to thank him so much. And again, remind you of Larson & Larson. They are my patent lawyers and my intellectual property lawyers. And right now, I'm going to be talking to somebody. Oh, I am so thrilled about this book. It is Explorer Academy, The Star Dunes. And I'm so happy to welcome Trudy Truitt. Hi, Trudy.
Hi.
Wow, wow, wow. This is a wonderful, wonderful book. I really, you know, I love the Explore Academy. I think it's so clever, the idea of it. And, you know, I want so much for children to read more. Now, I've been reading since I was 2 years old. I love reading. And so anything I can do to help promote reading, especially for younger people, I'm happy to do. And this new book is wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Well, you've done 100 books, I think, or something like that. And in this book, of course, let's talk a little bit about the whole gang that are back, Cruz, Sailor, and Emmett. And tell us about this wonderful group of children who are the next generation of explorers.
Well, you know, I didn't really realize when I wrote this book and researched it where we would be in terms of viruses. And,
yeah.
And in this particular story, the kids learn about diseases that are transmitted between animals and humans and humans and animals.
I know.
And I just, when I was researching this about a year and a half ago, about a year ago, I thought it was really fascinating. And it would be an interesting storyline to develop. And so what the explorers do, a little different than what we're facing here, is they learn that diseases that humans carry can actually be harmful to animals. And they discover that the common cold, for example, harmless to us, can actually be fatal to gorillas. And so their mission is to head out and save some gorillas from the common cold, and did not really realize where we would be in dealing with what we're dealing with now. But I think through the adventure, you know, maybe we can share with kids a little bit about our society, how we're interconnected with the creatures of the planet, and how it's important for us to, you know, learn about these kinds of things and get involved, not in a fearful way, but in a way that can, you know, help us live in harmony with animals of our planet.
Well, again, the book has just been, well, the entire series, I know it has really caught on with young people, and I'm really so thrilled that I've been part of this promotion of this book, because I talk a lot to parents groups and, you know, reading clubs, and I always want to tell them, make sure that the children I was going to, actually in May, I'm planning a whole month of young adult fiction and children's book for summer reading. I thought it would be summer reading. I think they are reading now. I think.
Yes. Yeah, it's a very good time to be a reader now that you're.
It is.
That we're all, you know, many of us are home from school and teachers. And I've had a lot of teachers and parents contact me, you know, which is fantastic because, you know, ultimately we want kids reading for pleasure and enjoyment. I mean, that's why we all read. But at the same time, it's also wonderful when you can sort of marry that with what I love too is nonfiction. And I've always, since I was a kid, I've always loved nonfiction and fiction. And so this is, for me, a great way to introduce kids to science in a way that, you know, is not like a textbook or hitting them over the head with facts and figures. It's just woven into the story as Cruz and his friends explore the world. They're also discovering, you know, about different cultures and societies, as well as scientific things like archaeology and climatology and volcanology and all kinds of different science fields that kids might find interesting and want to read more about.
Well, I want to encourage parents, really turn off the television and let the kids live this explorer world. Take a floor in your house and just create a world map on it. You know, have the kids lay things out, cut pieces of material, have them create their own maps, and just turn them into explorers. For me, I was raised on, we didn't have a lot of books. I was raised in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We couldn't afford a lot of books, but we did get National Geographic books, which is why the yellow, you know, the magazine. Why I became a world traveler because of Nat Geo. And so parents now, don't worry about messes. Don't worry about anything else. just let them create their worlds. Let them create, you know, trails through Africa. Let them set up clues and do all sorts of things. One of the things I did with my boys was we would go on safari, and I would create this spice box full of all, you know, I'd find little bottles and fill them with different spices. Uh-huh. And we'd travel all around the house, which of course was Africa to us. And we'd discover different spices and different things. And they could do the same thing with simpler, with, you know, print pictures of flowers and animals. Mm-hmm. And put them all over the house and turn all the kids into little explorers, and that they read these books, get excited. And I think the characters in these books are just wonderful. I mean, I really, you know, you guys have developed this wonderful gang, really a gang of characters that I think there's everybody can relate to.
Yeah, that's the one beautiful thing. I love that, creating a map on the floor. That's, you know, that's what imagination is all about. And, you know, when I was a kid, I was the same way, too. It was, you know, you use your imagination to create stories and learn about places and discover. And I really got my love of nonfiction from my librarian when I was a kid. My elementary school librarian would show me books and travel books, and I just found those incredibly fascinating. And you never know where those kind of places will take you. And the great thing about characters is that, you know, I hope when I write these books that I create characters that kids can relate to. And then sometimes characters that maybe they want to be but aren't. Like when I was a kid, I was a pretty shy kid. So it was nice to create Sailor, who is pretty strong and independent, and you know, nothing is going to stand in her way. That's the kind of girl that I always wanted to be, but was a little quiet and too shy to be. So when you read, you get to find characters that you can relate to, and then characters that you can model to and look up to and be inspired by.
And you've done it. Really, you've succeeded so well with this series. I love also the illustrations in the books. They're very, you know, just at the right time. I think, you know, that way kids just, they love turning the pages and seeing it, you know, when an illustration comes up. And they are beautifully done, beautifully.
Well, and in doing this, when the first book that we did, we actually spent a lot of time asking kids what they thought about, you know, the illustrations. And the illustrations are phenomenal, I think. Scott Plum is the illustrator. And he just did it, you know, they're full color and they're just so beautiful. But it was really important to us that kids and got something out of them, that they enjoyed them, and that they complement the text so well. And also, there are some little hidden pictures and codes and puzzles within some of the illustrations. So if kids linger on those a little while, they might find some hints and clues as to what's coming up in the story as well.
Yeah, it is just beautifully done. And I would suggest to parents, you know, get these books and actually, since you have time, you know, set up the video camera and have the kids talk about the books or have the kids do some of the dialogue. And let them turn into little actors and act out some of these scenes, because this is the way that they will get excited. If you just let them watch television, their minds are going to be dull for these next few months.
Some of the best videos, I have gotten videos from kids who have read the books, and then I had a couple of kids actually act out some of the scenes with their Legos. I mean, it was wonderful. They made a movie trailer. Oh my gosh, the things that you can do. If you, we have a website set up if people are interested.
Yes.
In exploreacademy.com, and that's a great place to go for resources. There's reader's guide. There's a teacher's guide there for each one of the books. There's videos that you can watch from some of the different explorers, and then you can also learn about some of the science behind the inspiration for the story. So there's lots to do at that website.
It's a wonderful website, and I just want to tell all you parents out there, get this new book. It's The Star Dunes, but now that you're all home, get all the books. And while I have you on the line, I want to tell you that now I love your series, Secrets of a Lab Rat.
Thank you.
Because I was a lab rat. I was always, I mean, my favorite subject in high school was chemistry. Well, no, two. I loved Latin. Uh-huh. I loved Latin because my Latin teacher was really good. So I took 4 years of Latin.
Wow.
And then I loved my chemistry class because I was, how can I say this? I was a little bit, I sort of hung out with the boys, and we were the type who made stink bombs. You couldn't get away with that today because hazmat would be there and you'd probably put away in some camp somewhere. But we did things like that. And so I've always thought of myself as a lab rat. And later on, when I was working in a hospital in a lab, I was still a lab rat because I simply love chemistry. So I would like to invite you back. I'm going to get in contact with you, and I'd like to have you back on. And I won't wait till May. We'll do it in April. You'll come on, and we'll talk about your lab rat series, okay?
Oh, I'd love to do that. Thank you. Yes.
Okay. So one more time, mention the webpage for Explorer Academy.
Sure. It's exploreracademy.com. And you can also go to my website, which is trudytruitt.com, and get some of the latest scoop on the books and when they'll be out, too. There's a few more links there as well.
Oh, I love the name Truitt. I think it's such a cool name. And it's
well. You can thank my husband for that.
Okay. Well, we'll thank him. He's got a great name there, and it's true. It's real easy and wonderful. I am so happy that you were on today, just in time to give parents some advice on what they can start reading. And then you'll be back on in April, and we'll get on with the lab rat business. Okay.
That sounds great. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate
it. You betcha.
Okay. You
Bye-bye.
Betcha. I love it. Okay. What is she from up north? She said, you betcha. Okay. Oh, now, do I have a wonderful book for you? Yeah, I'm holding it up to the camera in case you're looking at this on YouTube, and it's called Don't Look Down. But actually, look at this book because it's wonderful, and it's by Hillary Davidson. I'm so happy to welcome you back to Joy on Paper, Hillary.
Thank you so much for having me back, Patsy, and I'm thrilled you enjoyed the book.
Oh, I did. I feel so fortunate. Today, they gave me an extended hour. I'm not usually on at this time. I'm usually on from 11 to 12. But because it's the fifth anniversary, they added an hour.
Congratulations to you, by the way, on the anniversary. That's fantastic.
Well, thank you. I'm so thrilled. I'm having so much fun. And so because I wanted in this month of March, which I'm really turning into a marvelous month of celebration, I wanted to get all my favorite authors on, and so I was so happy that I was able to get you because...
Oh, my goodness, that is so kind of you.
ever since you were on, really thanks to our mutual friend, Lawrence Block, Mystery Writer of America, Grandmaster.
Yes, exactly.
and he's just... Well, what can I say? I saw him at BoucherCon.
He'll strangle me for saying this, but living legend. He is just the greatest, and he's also incredibly kind to other writers as well, and helps up and coming writers. So, yeah, he introduced us because he had me in an anthology that he put together last year, At Home in the Dark, and you had a few of the writers in that book on the program, and then you ended up taking an interest in. I had a new novel come out just after that, and had me back on the show, and so this is actually my third visit.
Yeah.
So I'm so honored that you'd have me back.
It's
absolutely delightful. Also, honestly, they say timing is everything, and I think with so many people sort of being at home right now and going a little stir crazy and that, it's kind of fortuitous that you're sort of having this exciting month of guests and that you have sort of an extra long show today. So.
Yes, because I want to encourage people to read. I always encourage people, but now they definitely need to be
read. A lot of writers have been making jokes, on Twitter about it, basically saying books have no expiration date. You never have enough books when you're in quarantine. And, unfortunately, it's true. I think we're all... adjusting to what's going to be the new normal for what might be weeks or even months to come. And, you're right, telling people about books, suddenly when you can't go out, books become this, wonderful sort of way into other worlds.
And they can relax you and take you mm-hmm. out of yourself and out of your current problems, get into somebody else's problems.
Much better place to be.
Hillary definitely knows how to take you into a real suspense, an action-packed book, and you'll forget about all the other problems going on around you.
That is a good way to look at it, actually, because I guess, you know, no matter, because it's tough for people right now, and especially, you know, people working from home. I've been working from home for so many years now, so I'm used to it, but people who suddenly have their whole families home with them, and maybe they have kids home with them, and, you know, it's not an easy place to be. But, you know, a crime novel can certainly put your problems into perspective. So, definitely, whatever your reality is, hopefully it won't be as bad as what's going on in the book.
Exactly. And what happens when you have really well-written characters, you get so into the book that you do forget. I mean, with this book, when people start reading it, I love your characters. I think you've just created here, this is the second book in the series, and Sharon is somebody that I think everybody will care about and want to read this story.
Oh, that is fantastic to hear. It's complicated always because, and I love, you know, that you know, enjoy the characters because it's a series, but it's sort of loosely organized. So the only prospective character that's back from the first book is NYPD Detective Sharon Sterling. And so even when you begin the book, it's sort of like a fresh character. It's a new character, a woman named Jo Griever who's been blackmailed. And in chapter one, she's actually going to meet her blackmailer. And she doesn't know who this is, but this person has been tormenting her for some time, hoping to, you know, pay them off and get the, you know, get video, get photographs, and end this. But she brings a gun with her to this meeting because she is also very afraid. And spoiler alert, everything goes downhill very quickly. I don't think it's a spoiler to say because it's chapter one, and, you know, basically by the end of that chapter, she and her blackmailer have shot each other. So,
but there are twists and there are turns, and you keep you know, there's a lot of dimension to this story. As you said, you brought back Sharon Sterling. Well, you had to because she is. Once you came out with that character, I think you know, an author comes out sometimes with a character that they say, oh boy, this is a character who is alive. You know, you can't, you couldn't stop writing her because she probably, you know, bang on your head in the middle of the night. You know, like, okay, I need you to get up here, start writing about me again.
Yeah, it really is true. And it's funny when that happens because people always ask, well, where do the characters come from? And it is so hard to explain because it honestly sounds kind of nuts when I say, well, usually for me, and certainly in the case of Sharon, I heard this voice like in the back of my brain. And so when I was writing the first book in the series, One Small Sacrifice, it centers primarily around this man who his girlfriend has gone missing, but the police are very interested in him because he was involved in the death of a female friend of his a year earlier before the book begins. And so, but the book was originally largely told from his perspective. And what happened was Sharon sort of took over more and more and more, and I hadn't set out to write a police procedural, but, you know, by the end of it, I had to admit that, yes, this is what I'm doing, because this amazing character really came alive in my mind. And it's hard to explain why that happens with some characters and not with others, but for me, I think six books in, I've kind of learned that you go with the flow. If you really sort of hear that character's voice, you know where they're coming from, you know their world, it's almost like a friend, like a new friend that you have, and they've sort of opened up to you, and they're telling you what they're thinking, and they're telling you what they're seeing. I've learned to just go with that, because for whatever reason, that kind of, you know, intuitive sense somehow transfers well onto the page, and it seems that it captures other people too. And I know that sometimes I've tried to force it, like I've had an idea for a character, but I'm not channeling the character the same way. And it's an uphill struggle. And I think the fact is, like, other people reading that, they don't get into that character the same way. All I can say is, like, I've been really excited by how people have reacted to her. And part of what's exciting about writing this series is that you're seeing things from the main suspect perspective. and from the lead investigator's perspective, because there's often a tendency to sort of sympathize with the perspective that you see the most. And you know, the famous example is Breaking Bad, where everyone sympathizes with Walter White, who, of course, is the villain of Breaking Bad. But you know, in the books, it means that you sort of have a certain amount of sympathy for all of the characters. And I hope that that sort of makes it a, like a richer reading experience for people.
Well, I think it does. And you introduce now the her partner. And again, very, very well, you know, a very well-drawn character, so that we, again, someone that we care about.
There was an interesting challenge with him, too, because it's not spoilery to say that there is he's injured at the end of the last book, and one of the few sort of plot points that carried on into this one is that he's back on the job, but he's still dealing with physical injuries and maybe even a certain amount of, like, PTSD from what he went through. And it was really interesting. I've never written a character who had sort of, like, physical challenges, disabilities. And cop culture tends to be a very macho culture. And so, you know, his partner even sort of wants him, like, why don't you just do desk duty? But there's this sense, like, you're on the job, you would be letting other officers down to go on desk duty. You don't want to hide behind a desk. So he's sort of fighting to be in the field. And it creates tension between, you know, Rafael Mendoza and Sharon Sterling, who are NYPD partners, both detectives. They're both good characters, and they both want to do the right thing, but there's this whole other layer of tension because of navigating this sort of new reality of navigating Rafael's injuries. So it was also kind of exciting to represent that, because I think, you know, it's often something we don't think about in our real lives. Like, it's, you know, you think that there are people who have these challenges and it's removed from you. But I was in an accident a few years ago where I ended up with one of my legs in a brace for months. I was hit by a car. And your whole world changes when you suddenly can't do things, like you can't, you know, walk upstairs. And you know, it really is like every part of your life you sort of look at differently. So it was, even though it's not like a major component of the book, I was glad to sort of be able to bring that to the page and talk about a cop working through those difficulties.
Well, it works. The whole story works. It's suspenseful. There are unexpected things happen, and I think that, again, this is a tour de force for you.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think that
so
you've done a great job, and I know that you're going to continue with this series, because I think it's going to turn into one of these very popular, and police procedural books are anyway quite popular, and I think this one is going to turn into a very popular series. And you've had some wonderful reviews from people, and
I've been very fortunate, like just sort of the notice that people have taken of the book. But that is so kind of you to say. I really do appreciate it, because when you're writing these things, you're always working in a vacuum on your own for so long. And so, you know, at any time I'm writing a book, I'm always hoping, even after doing this now several times, like this is my sixth book, each time it's like, can I really do this? Can I bring this to life? Can I make this story make sense? Because in your own mind as the writer, this stuff is alive, but all of it is about, are readers going to be interested? Are readers going to get into this? So honestly, it makes my heart sing when someone responds to a book like you do, Patsy. It is amazing. Thank you.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about an anthology too, is the minute people read anthologies, they usually find authors that they, you know, particularly are drawn to. And that's a wonderful thing that Larry is doing by bringing out all these anthologies.
Exactly. It's one of the reasons I love sort of collaborating on projects like that. There are usually several projects a year I do like that, because you get to write, like, work with a different group of writers, different group of editors, and you learn a lot, but it also exposes you to so many different styles of storytelling. I think there's nothing better than picking up an anthology, because you can just dive into the book wherever you want and sort of pick and choose and, you know, find old friends, meet new characters. It is a terrific experience.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Hillary Davidson, for being on Joy on Paper today to celebrate my fifth anniversary. The new book is Don't Look Down. Do you have a webpage you want people to go to?
Yeah, please visit hillarydavidson.com or come find me on Instagram at hillarydavidsonbooks. And you know, I love to interact with readers, and I also love doing book groups. I do book groups via Skype and stuff like that, so come find me, and I won't visit in person, but I will virtually visit your book group if you like.
And you can't visit in person anybody anyway?
Right, well, now. Yeah, so, these days, so I was going to say, so hopefully this will work. Will be able to.
Okay, well, yeah. I will talk to one of my book groups, and I'm sure they would love to do this, and so later on we'll arrange something like that, and people get this new book, Don't Look Down, and you'll find a new character, somebody that you really care about in Sharon Sterling. She's alive. To me, she's alive. She's real. And that's the best compliment I can give to an author.
And that is the highest compliment. Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. Thank you so much. And I'm so honored you would have me on this show today and you're celebrating the 5th anniversary. So thank you so much, Patsy. It means a lot.
Okay. And I'll talk to you again soon, okay?
Okay. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, she is so nice. She's just wonderful. And I want to thank, again, Larry Block for introducing us. He's so wonderful. He's got a new book coming out. He's going to be on the program in April. And meanwhile, check out his anthologies. Just go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and write Lawrence Block Anthologies. And he's got 3 different anthologies out there, all based on what he's been doing is he has been selecting artwork, and authors are writing stories based on the artwork. It's a fascinating way that he's created a wonderful array of stories, and there's sure to be something that you will love. And so please go to Amazon and check out Lawrence Block, and of course Hillary Davidson with her wonderful character, Sharon Sterling. You know, every once in a while you come across a new character whose name you won't forget, and all you'll have to do is hear that name once, and you'll know that it's going to be a suspenseful, exciting, very exciting, action-packed book, and Hillary Davidson did a great job with it. Again, I want to thank everybody for all of the wonderful emails I've been getting just about the 5th anniversary. I have had this privilege of talking now to 10 Mystery Writer of America Grandmasters, the Poet Laureate of the United States, over 200 New York Times bestselling authors. Wow, I'm just grateful to all of you, and grateful to my husband and my family, my son, and just thank you all. And special hello and kiss I'm throwing to the camera to all of them, and just thank you. And all, you know, you have time now. You're stuck in the house. Start writing your own book. You can do it. And my goddaughter Kanisha wrote a book in 4 times now. She's written a book in a month. So you can do it too. You have now maybe a couple months. We hope not, but maybe. And so you can write a book. And remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or a series on the Hallmark Channel. And I just want to say again, thank you, Big Ed in the control room. Thank you for everything. He's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. And I salute all of you out there. Thank you all very, very much. Bye-bye.